This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
That interview with Jeff Luhnow was conducted by our next guest who joins us on the hotline right now. She is one of the sports reporters, the great team over at KPRC Channel 2, Vanessa Richardson, joining us right now on Payne and Pendergast on Sports Radio 610. Vanessa, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, it's great to have you on, and nice job with getting that interview with Jeff Luhnow yesterday. I guess my first question, Vanessa, is what's your sense on why now for Jeff Luhnow to give his side of the story on everything?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I started talking to he and his wife about doing this a couple of months ago, and he wanted to wait until the Astros were done. He didn't want to step on their toes or try to steal their shine. And I just think that he had taken a few months to gather his thoughts and was ready to tell his side of the story. And I know, you know, like he had talked about a little bit in the interview, he, you know, obviously is a lawyer. And so he's just thought about it for a while and wanted to share his side. And so I was happy to help him do that. And, you know, with, like I've said from the beginning, whether people believe him or not, you know, that wasn't my goal. It was just help him share his side, and then Astros fans can decide for themselves.
I think one of the things he kept coming back to in the interview, which was really interesting, because in my mind, I was kind of going through the timeline as I remember it and the various emails that were disclosed. And one of his points was that a lot of the evidence that was brought up against him is really circumstantial, and there wasn't really a smoking gun that said, "Hey, this is Jeff Luhnow weighing in on the sign stealing and the relaying to second base specifically." Were there any points where afterwards you thought, "Okay, well, that maybe there was more of a mismatch there than he was letting on?"
I think that what he had evidence of, and definitely compelling evidence of, is that he was a scapegoat in certain situations, right? So he talks about the Brandon Taubman incident, and according to him, you know, he has texts from people that said, "Thanks for taking one for the team." And he has, you know, these texts that say, "Don't tell Jeff," when they're talking about Codebreaker. Imagine being able to see people who worked for you, their texts for the last 3 years, right? Like, wouldn't that be crazy? So I think that, you know, I don't know that there was a smoking gun that convinced Rob Manfred that he, you know, knew about cheating, but it all boiled down to the fact that he was copied on a couple of lengthy emails.
Vanessa Richardson, KPRC Channel 2, joining us on Sports Radio 610. She conducted the interview with Jeff Luhnow, which you've heard bits and pieces of throughout the show today. You mentioned Brandon Taubman, Vanessa, and I'm curious your thoughts on this, especially your perspective as a female reporter. We know the story of Brandon Taubman, what he did that ended up getting him fired. As I watched Jeff Luhnow answer your questions about that, I got to wondering, what's the bigger stain for Jeff Luhnow that he felt like he needed to remedy? Is it the perceived role in the sign stealing, or is it the perceived role in the handling of the Brandon Taubman incident by the Astros?
Yeah, I told him, you know, before the interview that I had to ask him about some other things that happened, and I'll give him credit. You know, he said that there weren't questions that were off limits, but maybe it's because I'm a female reporter, guys, but that was the thing that I remember. I was like, if I ask about anything other than the cheating, obviously it has to be that, because it was so egregious. I mean, they sent out a press release that said that this female reporter was lying. I just remember how much of a disaster it was, and I'm sure you guys do too. So I think that he wanted to clear up the fact that, according to him, he's not the one that wrote that initial press release, But he, you know, he was the one in Washington, D.C. that gave that press conference that did not go over well before the World Series. So I think that he wanted to clear that up. And again, just that idea of being a scapegoat is something that really seemed heavy on his mind and something that he wanted to clear the air. Again, whether people believe him or not, who knows? But I could tell that when I asked about that, he actually wanted to address it, which I was surprised about.
Were you, I guess there were a couple moments in the interview where I was kind of caught off guard where it looked like he was starting to get choked up because he did a pretty good job the entire time of being very Jeff Luhnow-like.
Right.
But were you caught off guard a little bit by that? And I'm pretty cynical and skeptical of things, so I went back and watched it a few times, and I thought, oh, that looks like genuine emotion. That doesn't look like he had it in his notes, show emotion here.
Yeah, I was surprised, and I think that it's interesting that he was getting emotional because he is, like you said, always so professional, so buttoned up. And everybody knows that about him, right? Like, I moved here in August of 2019. I don't have some long history of covering Jeff Luhnow. And even I know, I mean, that he is usually very buttoned up and very professional. But, you know, you're also talking about somebody that had their name, you know, dragged through the mud, whether people think he deserved it or not. And it was hard for him to talk about. He also really never talked about it before on air at all, right? Like, he had, I'm sure, talked about it to his family, to his lawyer, to his friends, but he had never done an interview about it. So that was surprising to me, too. And, Seth, your reaction from people has been the reaction I've gotten a lot of as well, which is I didn't expect him to get that emotional.
Yeah, there's no doubt that he still feels a connection to the organization, said he still roots for them when you asked him about that. Vanessa Richardson joining us right now on Sports Radio 610. He also said that he mentioned Apple Watches, and I thought, Vanessa, early on in the interview, when I heard that answer, I said, okay, that's something we did not know, that we know that he went to A.J. Hinch after the memo was sent from Major League Baseball in 2017 about the Red Sox and the Yankees, and specifically the Apple Watches with the Red Sox. That was the first mention that I can remember of an anecdote being shared about an Apple Watch in the Astros dugout. Do we know that it was an Apple Watch that was being used for the nefarious baseball purposes? What was your reaction when he said that?
I loved it. Seth said that it might have been, one of you said it might have been used for steps, right?
Yeah, that was me.
That did make me laugh. That definitely raised my eyebrows, too. And are we to the point maybe where we're just assuming that most teams were using Apple Watches? Like, I don't – because to your point, Sean, I thought that, too. And I really didn't see anybody say much about that. So, that made me raise my eyebrows. And I think that it – I think it's indicative of just how many teams – look, I'm not saying every team used Apple Watches, that every team was sign-stealing, whatever. But I think it is indicative that so much of this is league-wide, right, guys? I mean, the fact that no one's really pointing that out, I think that's crazy. And that was surprising for me to hear.
You know, the other thing that I think at least a couple times, he wanted to make a distinction between decoding signs, picking up on pitchers' tells. Those two things are different and allowable compared to, you know, the trash can and relaying to the runner from the dugout. All of that stuff's very illegal. I think that I get a sense that he's probably getting frustrated with some of the mischaracterization of the things the Astros do that are completely legal.
Yeah, I absolutely think that he is getting frustrated by that, because he talked about, if you watch the full 37-minute interview that's on our website on click2houston.com, little plug there, he did go into what's legal and what's not. We couldn't put all of it in the interview, but he talked, and most baseball fans will know, right? But he goes at length into pitch tipping. He goes at length into what's legal and illegal. And I go back to, I remember when this first happened, and Bob Costas doing an interview and explaining, you know, it's like you can study for the SAT, but you can't look at your laptop during the test, right? So a lot of quote-unquote sign stealing is legal, but you can't use technology to do it. And Jeff really went into depth about conversations that he had had with Rob Manfred and other people in baseball in that full interview that I thought was really interesting. But yeah, I do think he was frustrated because he says in the interview that Rob Manfred says many teams were pitch tipping and all of that. So yeah, I think that he was definitely frustrated by that kind of notion that everything is illegal and that, you know, you're not allowed to do anything. And he's kind of saying, hold up, you know, pump the brakes there.
It's Vanessa Richardson, and we DVR'd the interview in our house, Vanessa, but I recommend, if you DVR'd it, I recommend instead going and listening to watching and listening to the full 37-minute interview at click2houston.com. A really good conversation if you're interested in Jeff Luhnow's side of the story of the sign-stealing scandal. A lot of detail, some new stuff in there as well, what Jeff Luhnow's looking to maybe do in his next phase of life, which is very, very interesting, given some vacancies around here, for sure.
Right.
But you can get Vanessa on Twitter, at SportsVanessa on Twitter, and of course catch her on KPRC Channel 2. Vanessa, great job, and we appreciate you spending a few minutes with us talking about it.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
All right, there it is. Vanessa Richardson joining us here on Sports Radio 610. All right, yeah, highly recommend that. We'll probably sprinkle in some more Luhnow from that interview throughout the show today. Speaking of general managers and former general managers, Daryl Morey took out a full-page ad in the Chronicle. There is one sentence in bold in the entire few thousand words in this, and we will see if we agree with Daryl Morey on those bold words about one particular player in his full-page ad. That's next. All right, so Daryl Morey took out a full-page ad in the Chronicle and has a fairly lengthy thank you note to Rocket fans and to several people that he's worked with along the way. Both worked with the entire time there, like Tad Brown, thanking the owners that he has worked for, Les Alexander and Tillman Fertitta, listing all the coaches, scouts, people in the front office that have worked alongside him, several of the players, goes through the different eras of basketball that he was a part of. The money shot in Daryl Morey's thank you note here in the Chronicle, though, comes here. He talks about the team with Yao and Tracy, and it had some real try-hard guys on it, like Carl Landry, Kyle Lowry before he became an all-star, Dikembe Mutombo, Shane Battier, I know is a big favorite of Daryl Morey's, Ron Artest for the year that he was with the team. He said, that team was unfortunately derailed by injuries. We remained a fun, hard-working group afterwards, but it did teach us that life, what life was like without a superstar in the NBA. And then, ... And then Seth, bold font with its own paragraph, James Harden changed my life. This is Daryl Morey. He says, an entire page could be dedicated just to James. He not only transformed my life, but he also revolutionized the game of basketball and continues to do so like almost no one has before. I'm not here to tell Daryl Morey who changes and doesn't change his life. The James Harden acquisition was absolutely game-changing for this franchise. And yes, definitely game-changing for the trajectory of Daryl Morey's time as GM. I'm more intrigued by the follow-up sentence to that. James Harden revolutionizing the game. I think when that gets mentioned, that's mentioned as something that's a real, real positive, the way Michael Jordan revolutionized the game. I don't know that people necessarily view James Harden's revolutionizing of the game as the positive from previous revolutionizations of the game that we've seen.
Yeah, the revolutionizations, yes, of the game.
Right.
Right. And yet it was a move that never could have been predicted or projected, and I think that Morey had that ability to do all those things. Like, I'll always look at the James Harden trade as the best example of, hey, look what happens when you never stop working. It's not like Daryl Morey had spent 3 years trying to figure out a way to get James Harden in the building. But because he was constantly looking and working and always wheeling and dealing, and because he was constantly open to new things or to new opportunities and to shift on the fly, that's how that all happened. You know, anybody in the league could have made that trade,
yeah,
but Harden or Morey just did it because of his reputation, his relationships with everybody else, the fact that he was willing to just changed course on the drop of a hat. And that's how Harden came to him. And I don't know. I see a lot of people these days say, like, well, you know, most people didn't realize what James Harden could be at that point. And then they act like they knew that James Harden was going to be just fine as a guy that could drive a team. Daryl Morey, to his credit, will tell you that he never foresaw it going as well as it did with James Harden.
Yeah, he thought he was going to be good. I think he thought he could be an all-star. He never thought he would be a perennial top three in the MVP for 4 or 5 years in a row type of guy. And a guy who, look, whether you like the style of play that James employs aesthetically or whether you find it an offense to your basketball senses, and there are people on both sides of that aisle. There are people who find James Harden's game to be fascinating, the way he has found inefficiencies in the game and his ability to take advantage of them, whether it's getting to the free throw line as frequently as he does, way more than any other player the last few years. The ability to take the rules of footwork and turn it into a sidestep, step back three and have that become a staple. There's no question that there are people who are emulating that, and maybe, depending on your opinion, maybe to the detriment of the game. But this is what the rules allow, and James has found, I think James, maybe better than any other player I can remember, has found glitches in the matrix, because he's not a guy who overwhelms you with his athletic ability. You know, guys who normally revolutionize the game, like Magic Johnson revolutionized the game because he was a 6'9" point guard. Michael Jordan revolutionized the game because he was a maniacal competitor who could fly. James is somebody who is, in a lot of ways, playing chess out there, revolutionizing the game.
You know, but part of that, though, too, is that he's deceptively fast. I mean, he's faster to the hole than just about anybody in the league. But the problem is, in basketball, when you think of athleticism, you think of vertical athletes instead of horizontal athletes.
Yeah.
You know, there's actually very little full-speed sprinting in basketball. And yet, that's what Harden is really good at, is driving. And then because of that, his lightning-quick step back becomes that lethal. But that's just, like, another way that he breaks type. I've always kind of grated against calling his an old man game, because there is a whole lot of speed and explosiveness to his game. It's just that he's got so much craftiness attached to it.
I think James is, to me, one of the most underrated things with James. I'm not going to say it's the best. The best thing about James is a guy can go out and score 60 every night if he wanted to. But one of the most underrated things, Seth, with James Harden is that when he gets knocked down and it looks like he's hurt and it looks like most guys would be limping off the court or would have to be helped off the court, he gets up every single time. Think of the last time. No. What?
You don't have to make it look like that. It's like, do you think that he was actually that hurt for, like, the fact that he got up?
No, but I'm saying the guy answers the bell. I mean, I'll just point to the games played column. The guy never manages. The guy gets up every time. Yeah, is there exaggeration and thespianism that goes on with NBA players? Yes, there is. But I guess maybe just separate that for a second. The dude answers the bell every time. Availability is one of his greatest abilities.
No, the first game he had missed in forever was when he was suspended for kicking Shaq in the Nargs.
Right.
Or not Shaq. Who did he kick in the Nargs? Who was it? Text line, let me know, 713-572-4610. It definitely wasn't Shaq.
No.
That would have had to happen on the TV set. If he just came in, that would have been awesome. If he'd gotten pissed off at the Inside the NBA guys and he just came in and planted one right on Shaq's danglers.
Well, Shaq probably said some things along the way about James that would invoke him to do that, I would imagine.
Dwight Howard would have come in and given him a glove slap. Yeah, he would have taken off his white gloves and said, "How dare you, sir?"
When do we get Bill O'Brien's full page ad in the Chronicle? Isn't this supposed to be?
He's too smart for that. He doesn't need to be taking out an ad in a newspaper.
It's just a nice gesture. You're supposed to do that when you get fired. Gary Kubiak did it before O'Brien.
O'Brien doesn't even know this, but he needs a Twitter account. I would love if O'Brien went full John McClane during a football game and just gave his stream of consciousness, just whatever's on his mind at any given moment. No coach would ever do this as long as they've got any fantasies of still coaching again. But I think O'Brien might be the best at it if you were to do that.
Jeff Luno said in his interview with Vanessa Richardson that he still rooted for the Astros during the postseason. I tend to believe him because of the connection he had with putting that roster together. Daryl Morey said he's going to continue to root for the Rockets, and I believe that. So long as James Harden is with the team, he will root for the Rockets. I do believe that. So long as it doesn't conflict with his interests if he's a GM for another team. Do you think Bill O'Brien watched the game on Sunday hoping that the Texans would beat the Tennessee Titans in overtime?
No, I think that there's a certain amount of Schadenfreude that it's acceptable when you get fired. It's hard for a coach because he's got personal relationships with the guys on the team too. Like, you want your, how much do you want the guys you know to succeed versus how much do some of the people that you know, how much do you want them to fail?
Right.
I would imagine right now Bill O'Brien has got to be feeling a little bit conflicted over his need to be as classy as possible, but to also want to talk a whole lot of smack about Jack Easterby. Those two things, like, all right, I'm going, now, I got to tell you, and anybody listening right now, this is tough advice to give, but it's something like I feel like I'm going to start giving it out more. If you get fired or lose your job, you got to fight like hell not to try to leave a few choice words on your way out the door.
Yeah.
I've seen, like, in this industry, especially over the last 6 months, obviously a lot of people have lost their jobs, and I've seen some like really good dudes burn bridges that they did not need to burn, like, on their way out the door.
That's
just
not good.
So I think O'Brien's probably right in that mode right now. He's too smart to just start planting bombs everywhere for his own good.
He's
but he
too
sure
smart
would love
to do what you're telling him to do, which is get a Twitter account. You're trying to pull him in front of the train. All right.
He might now, if he wants to step away from coaching altogether, like if he wants to go run a Chick-fil-A like Tony Levine did, then go ahead, start dishing out. It doesn't matter anymore. But if you want to stay in the fraternity, you got to kind of bite your tongue.
Bill O'Brien running a Chick-fil-A. Boy, Tony Levine is an ultimately patient and quiet and peaceful man. Bill O'Brien running any sort of fast food operation is that would be a reality show.
It would be like the surliest Chick-fil-A you've ever been to. You know, you go to, see, I was like, Chick-fil-A, the biggest problem is that sometimes they're a little too sunny for my liking. They're a little too happy and friendly. Oh, my God. You know what it would be? O'Brien's Chick-fil-A would be more like the, you'd go up to Chick-fil-A and think that you were at a Popeyes. You're like, wait, what's going on here? This is oil. Why is everything so damn clean? And it would be awesome. It would be an awesome experience.
All right. We will take a trip around the old NFL candy store, take a look at action from Sunday and Monday, the Monday doubleheader. We do it every Tuesday at 8:35. Take a trip around the league via highlights. And how do we come away feeling about some of the Texans' future opponents? Is the schedule harder or easier than it looked before the season started? We will go through the highlights, take a trip around the league next. Sean Pendergast, Seth Payne with you on a Tuesday, and it's about 8:35-ish. So we take a spin around the league and go back and look at the week that was during week 6 of the NFL season. We take a look around the candy
crazy
store.
That is
the NFL schedule. Yeah, it was
over a third of the way done with the season already.
I know. It goes by fast, man. It goes by fast. And by the way, Seth, it may not be over a third. If we get a week 18, it will be at exactly a third.
We may get those
extra weeks at the end. Yeah, I'm just trying to extend this thing for as long as possible.
I was just thinking even in terms of number of games played, though,
sure.
At least. And
yeah.
We're over a third of the way done.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. So let's take a spin around the league, and let's start in Indianapolis, where the Indianapolis Colts fell behind big against the Cincinnati Bengals, who are 1-4-1 on the season, but dare I say a frisky 1-4-1. They fell behind 24-7. Took a while, but eventually the Colts were able to regain the lead.
Rivers back to throw on 1st and 10 in the end zone. A diving catch for Jack
got
Doyle. Touchdown! Touchdown! Jack Doyle! And the Colts are tying the ball game right now. It's 27-27. A 14-yard beautiful throw from Phillip Rivers.
Seth, where are we at on the Indianapolis Colts? They're 4-2 on the season. Statistically, they have an elite defense right now. But there had been chatter about Phillip Rivers getting replaced by Jacoby Brissett not all that long ago. They were able to put up 31 points against the woeful Bengals, and I suppose this is one of those games that if they go on to make the playoffs and maybe win a game or two in the postseason, you look back and go, well, every team has those kind of days where a bad team hangs around like that. What are your thoughts on the Colts at this point?
I feel like I was one of the people who in the offseason said, hey, you can't judge Phillip Rivers based on just the low light real bad throws because everybody has those. I'm leaning more and more towards, okay, yeah, he's following the conventional path of an aging NFL quarterback.
Yeah.
And that I know this offensive line isn't quite what it was cracked up to be, but it's still way better than anything he had in San Diego. And we're still seeing a lot of Phillip Rivers types of throws. So I'm not, But I'm also like, okay, am I worried about the Texans playing them? Yes.
Yeah, of course.
Yes, I am. Yeah. The Colts defensive line didn't do an incredible job here. DeForest Buckner was the only guy that really got a lot of pressure on Burroughs, which that was a good offseason acquisition for them. They spent heavily for him as a first-round pick, and it's one that you should be concerned about if you're the Texans, because that Zach Fulton part of the offensive line is still an issue in pass protection. Also, the one thing that I would note about this game, Sean, is we'll continue our theme of always pointing out when rookies play well
right.
on other teams.
Or at
Since
all.
The Texans, even after Bill O'Brien has left the building, seem adamant that they just don't want to play hardly any of the rookies at all.
Yeah.
Julian Blackman, the rookie safety for the Colts, sealed the game with an interception of Jake Burrow.
A
rookie, by the way, the guy that actually had them in the game for the first 3 weeks.
So it's possible for rookie players to actually play in the secondary for NFL teams.
That's meaningful plays.
Yeah, that can happen.
Wow.
All right, shifting gears and heading to New England, where the Patriots took on the Denver Broncos. And the Broncos, a game that the Broncos led pretty much from beginning to end, a low-scoring game, but the Patriots had the ball late in the game, driving the field, down by 6, trying to get a game-winning touchdown, and the Denver defense stood up.
4th and 10. See if Denver brings some pressure. They do. Safety blitz on the way. Newton in the pocket. Hit as he throws. Loads it up, and it's incomplete. Denver's defense with a huge stop. And Denver simply must take a knee 3 times to end this game.
All right, so there you go. And they did that. They win 18-12 over the New England Patriots. Seth, the Patriots are 2-3 now on the year. I know one of those losses was with Brian Hoyer replacing Cam Newton with the COVID. I went and did the research last night. This is the deepest into a season, 6 weeks, that the Patriots have been below 500 since 2002, which coincidentally is the last year that they, that is the last year that they did not win double digit games, was in 2002. That was after their first Super Bowl win.
Oh, that's right. The year after their first Super Bowl win, they actually had a little bit of a
they went 9-7 that year. Yeah.
Yeah.
This is the furthest into a season they've been below 500 since that year. At 2-3.
I know you love these like drive stats and stuff like that. You like the kind of the gambling stuff.
Sure.
The Patriots averaged 20 plays per drive in this game.
What?
Yeah. Like a first down and a little bit more usually.
How is that even possible? And scored 12 points?
They fumbled 4 times. They only lost one of them.
Okay.
And they averaged 20 points. What's that?
No. I said they only scored 12 points and they averaged 20 plays on each drive?
No. I'm sorry. 20 yards per drive.
Oh, you said 20 plays each drive.
Oh, that's a big difference. 20 plays would be phenomenal.
Yeah.
No. 20 yards. I was wondering why you were acting like it was such a good thing. What are you talking about?
No, you said 20 plays. Holy crap.
They averaged 20 yards per drive overall.
No, that's not good at all. That lines up with scoring 12 points right there.
A few things here. One, I don't know if you had noticed or not, but Tom Brady's not on this team anymore. I know a lot of people wanted to try to blame Tom Brady getting old. Tampa Bay Buccaneers is doing splendidly, by the way.
Right.
They just completely trounced your next opponent, the Green Bay Packers. Mm-hmm. Any Texans fans out there? But they don't seem to be playing with the discipline. The offensive line pretty much just allowed Denver to have their way with Cam Newton. And look, Dante Scarnecchia, the longtime offensive line coach for the Patriots, retired this offseason. When you don't have Tom Brady kind of acting as your quasi-offensive coordinator, when you don't have Dante Scarnecchia coaching your offensive line, you're not going to do good things. And that's by the way, you haven't improved your receiving core much over anything that you gave Tom Brady last year. This problem is more about Bill Belichick, the general manager, and Bill Belichick, the head football coach, who has a losing record as a coach without Tom Brady.
Sing it, Seth.
He's no better. He's actually much worse than Bill O'Brien when it comes to quarterbacking without Tom Brady.
There you go. All right, let's move on to Philadelphia, where the Eagles, trying to keep pace with the 2-4 Dallas Cowboys to somehow stay atop the wretched NFC East, they took on the Baltimore Ravens in a game that the Ravens were seemingly in control throughout most of the game, but the Eagles had some chances. Ultimately, the Ravens wind up winning by two behind the legs of Lamar Jackson.
Jackson will keep it on the read option. Big hole up the middle. 30, 20, 10, 5, touchdown Ravens. Lamar Jackson right up the middle.
Lamar Jackson finishes, Seth, with 9 carries for a 108 and that 47-yard touchdown courtesy of the Ravens radio network.
Is that Jerry Sandusky?
I believe it is, yes.
Yeah. Wait. No, good, Jerry? No, wait.
Yes, Jerry Sandusky.
Oh, that's right. It's the exact same name. It's spelled a little differently. Yeah. I almost said, like, I said Jerry Sandusky, and I thought, like, oh, wait, no, that's the name of the actual child predator. Like, no, Jerry Sandusky, the Ravens. He's a really good – I like his calls. Yeah. I enjoy listening to the Ravens calls. Wentz looked exactly like himself. He's just an absolute wreck this year. The one excuse I'd give him is that – he doesn't really have a whole lot of talent around him or talent protecting him.
Dude.
And I think that all that does is – that's not a complete and total excuse. I think there are some quarterbacks that still make a show of it when all those things are happening. But Wentz just isn't that guy. He's not going to be the guy that makes everybody else around him into all of a sudden credible football players. But he was just – he was 11 of 20 for 120 yards and sacked 4 times when he was under pressure. It was really bad.
They're missing Andre Dillard, Brandon Brooks, Jason Peters. I think Lane Johnson missed that game on Sunday. He has nobody in front of him on that offensive line. It's no excuse, and I'm not a huge Carson. I guess it is an excuse, and I'm not a big Carson Wentz fan. Like I think even behind a good offensive line, I think he's a little overrated. But he's got nobody in front of him right now. And Lamar Jackson, 186 yards passing, 108 yards on the ground. Just ho-hum another day at the office for him. Meanwhile,
it is.
Go ahead.
Well, that is something about the Ravens offense. It's weird. The Ravens are a really, really good team, and they're a very well balanced team. But there's something that's just not quite as scary about the offense right now or Lamar Jackson. And I feel foolish for saying that as I say it out loud because I'm sure it's going to swing back. But it's something to monitor. Yeah. That there's just something, there's something that doesn't feel quite like the same thing as last year about the Ravens.
Meanwhile, the team the Ravens are chasing in the AFC North, the Pittsburgh Steelers, they welcome the Cleveland Browns to town. The Browns coming in on a 4-game winning streak into this game with a 4-1 record. Felt a little fugazi, the 4-1 record with Cleveland. They haven't played great defense. Baker Mayfield has been well protected in Stefanski's scheme there, hasn't been asked to do too much. And it came back to roost on Sunday. The Pittsburgh Steelers, clearly the better team, and they got started early with a touchdown on the defensive side of the ball.
Mayfield shotgun snap, throws over the middle, intercepted. It is Minkah Fitzpatrick, 25, 20, 15, 10, touchdown, Minkah. People have been asking, where's Minkah Fitzpatrick? Baker Mayfield just found out.
That's a great call right there. How about this for a stat, Seth? Cleveland's 4-2 on the year right now, right? Pretty good, 4-2. You'd take that if you're a Cleveland Browns fan, but they have a point differential in their 4 wins of plus 39. That's solid. It's, you know, average about 10 point margin each game. Their 2 losses, both in the division, by the way, are by a margin of cumulatively negative 63. Their 2 losses are 38-6 to the Ravens and 38-7 to the Steelers. What do we make of the Cleveland Browns at this point?
Well, I think there's a common denominator there, right? Which is, oh, wow, when you come up against a genuinely good defense,
Baker's a mess.
Yeah, he's a mess right now. And they're doing well despite Baker Mayfield. I think even Browns fans would have told you, yeah, they're doing a lot of really good things, but Baker Mayfield doesn't look a whole lot better than last year. He's got the excuse of that rib injury in this game. He got benched for Case Keenum halfway through. But I think there's other parts of his game right now. When you watch it, it looks like, look, he looks completely mentally lost. Like, it looks like he's not even looking at the right spot on the field. And I don't know if he's panicking or what have you, but it doesn't even look like he's following the actual, I would say the progression, but I'm talking about even like where he's supposed to look first. It's not like, oh, he's not going 1, 2, 3, 4 through his progressions. It looks like he's completely lost at times. One of the telling stats is always, how does a guy do from a clean pocket? Because that really, okay, that shows, all right, when there's no pressure and everything, how is a guy? That's when it's most like the pure NFL passing game. In this game, when Mayfield was free from pressure, he was 7 for 11 for 74 yards with a pick 6. That one of Minkah Fitzpatrick that we just listened
Indeed.
To. It wasn't any good. There was nothing impressive about him from a clean pocket. So you can't blame it on the offensive line or anything else. He's just struggling this year.
Last one, the Texans' opponent next week is the Green Bay Packers. They jumped out to a 10-0 lead against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. And then they didn't score the rest of the afternoon, and Tampa Bay poured it on 38 straight points, including this little hookup between two old friends.
But here's the snap on third and six. Lob pass toward the end zone. Gronkowski, he makes the catch. Touchdown, Tampa Bay. What a great grab by Gronk. Holy Gronkamole. The Bucs score a touchdown with a minute two to go.
Holy Gronkamole. That obviously courtesy of the Buccaneers Radio Network. Gronkowski, Seth, a little bit of a turn back the clock game. 5 catches for 78 yards. He's been an afterthought in that offense all year long. But not only 5 catches, 78 yards, but they were acrobatic, old-school Gronkowski catches. The Tampa Bay Buccaneers, it looks like Tom Brady is winning the war against Bill Belichick right now, and which guy needs the other one more, I would say.
It was a little bit of a play by Gronkowski that you could see him doing again just because it was more about his body size than it was anything else. He threw a fade to Gronkowski. He's got a defensive back on him. And then, look, Brady remembers the old days. You got a defensive back on Gronkowski. I like that matchup. You just throw it up to him, and all of a sudden he turns into DeAndre Hopkins. I think that the notable thing about this game was I was watching in the first quarter. I actually watched this early this morning. And I'm thinking, like, wow, this doesn't look like I read about. The Packers are actually moving the ball pretty easily versus the Bucs. The Bucs started off just rushing 4 and not doing a whole lot, playing it pretty safe and conservative. Todd Bowles is their defensive coordinator, and Todd Bowles is a known quality defensive coordinator. Not much as a head coach, but a quality defensive coordinator.
No doubt.
It was like there was a tipping point where once Bowles decided after the first couple series, all right, we're going to turn up the heat a little bit, and they started blitzing, that was it. It was lights out. I mean, Green Bay started turning the ball over seemingly every possession. They were harassing Aaron Rodgers. I told you, Ndamukong Suh looked like he was going to literally rip the head off of Aaron Rodgers at the end of the first half, which would have been a tragedy, I'm sure. But that defense just got after it. So, yes, the Green Bay offense took a step backwards. I don't think that affects the Texans game one bit because that Tampa defense is for real. They got studs all over the place. If you want a guy that you used to think, for the people that thought that Zach Cunningham was getting screwed out of being all pro last year, go ahead and watch Levante David play football. And then ask yourself if you see that same stuff from Zach Cunningham.
Does he have to stand up while he makes tackles, Levante David, Seth, or is he actually able to go somewhat horizontal and make form tackles?
You know, it was interesting. I actually watched for that specifically. He actually went to the ground as he was making tackles. He didn't try to stay on his feet at all costs. Sean, heroism. You don't see it a lot these days, but when I see an inside linebacker who's willing to actually wrap a guy up and go to the ground, hero.
Yeah. No, some heroes don't wear capes. They wear Levante David jerseys, and their name is Levante David. All right. Speaking of heroes, David Anderson, former Houston Texans wide receiver, he's going to join us in the next segment. DA lives in the analytics world now. That's his job. His life is in the statistical end of things football-wise. I'm curious what he thinks the Texans should be looking for in a new head coach and how he views that. So we'll talk about that with David Anderson up next. You're listening to Payne and Pendergast Sports Radio 610.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.